You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Few people can argue that the country isn't heavily politically divided right now. We saw that with this last election. We've seen that over the past 4 years and beyond. Racial divides have deepened. People are polarized. And it feels like even having conversations with each other is a task that's so burdensome and can be emotionally loaded and just tiring. President Joe Biden dedicated his inaugural speech to unifying the country, finding common ground. But how? The Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley has been tackling these questions. How do we talk to each other when it feels like we're so divided? How do we start hearing one another and create a place where everyone feels welcome? John A. Powell heads the Institute. He's a longtime civil rights lawyer and racial justice leader. He's consulted with the Obama administration, and now he's consulting with the Biden administration. And he led a recent forum after the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. I spoke to him right after that. Why did you feel you needed to have a conversation about that day, and what did you want the conversation to be about?
Well, one of the things was just to give people a chance to reflect collectively, because when things like this happen, it's actually hard to know what to think. Mm. And our thinking is a collective process. So we get more information, our thinking change. And there's some sadness, some grievance, some anger, some fear. But we're also coming off the Georgia election that was really historical, not because simply electing two Democratics, senators, one African-American, one Jewish, but in Georgia, you know, the deep South, sort of the home of a lot of people who embraced the Civil War. There's a big Civil War theme park in Georgia, I think the largest in the country, Stone Mountain, the heart of segregation. And to see what happened in Georgia, you know, in some ways, I can understand Trump's frustration. It's like, I couldn't lose Georgia. Maybe I could lose Michigan. Maybe I could lose Pennsylvania. But Georgia? Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. And so the flip side of that is that Georgia's changing. The South is changing. And there's a potential change for the whole country. So I think it's important when we're dealing with these complex feelings, not to get stuck in one place. Not to just be despondent, sad, and or not to be glib. This is very serious. What we do and don't do matter. How we talk about this matters. And there are options. So part of what we're hoping with this on Friday was that people would see the complexity of it and hold on to it and not get stuck in being very glib and cynical on one hand, but also feeling that there's still some possibility.
You know, you've said this is not new. You said it's not over. It didn't start this week and it doesn't end this week. In your work, in your dialogue with people, what makes people believe that we're in a post-racial society and then they're shocked when something like this happens?
Well, I think part of it is just wanting to get beyond hard stuff. I mean, race has been a hard issue for the United States forever, really. And sometimes it simmers and sometimes it boils, but it's never gone away. And it affects so much of our politics. It affects our economy. It affects where we live. It affects where we go to church. It affects our friendship. And there have been multiple expressions of it, not a single expression. And people of goodwill, it's like, can we get beyond this? Can we stop doing this? Can we actually get to the place where we just recognize each other as people? You know, the famous, can't we all just get along? Why can't we just all get along? And there's an answer to that. There's a hope. It's like, I'm tired of, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. But it doesn't stop because we're tired. It's like the pandemic, because we're tired of it doesn't mean it's going to go away. So we can decide to, okay, I'm not going to wear a mask anymore. I'm going to go outside. I'm going to hang out with my friends. The virus is still there. The same is true with our history of how we do race and racism. It's not going to go away because we get tired. We can't wish it away. We have to do real work. It's embedded in so much of our lives, so much of our institutions, so much of our economy, that if we're going to change it, we have to actually look at all those things. Otherwise, it will reproduce itself. Mm-hmm. And just like the virus, so I understand people wanting people of goodwill. I was at the Democratic Convention when Obama was first nominated for president, and there's all this talk about post-racialism. It's like, well, and actually I gave a talk and I said, I don't think so. Not so fast. That's maybe a wonderful aspiration, maybe, but we're not there. The same when we talk about colorblind. We do work around the mind science. We know that the mind actually notices race fast. The unconscious notices before the conscious could even come online. And that's sociological, not biological. We've been primed, we've been educated, we've been acculturated. So race is a defining issue in our society. And if that's going to change, we have to do a lot of work.
You know, a lot of people are fearful of these times. A lot of people arming themselves. A lot of people black-sitting, which is black-sit, kind of a black exodus from the U.S., people just moving from this country. You know, folks are afraid or tired. What do you do with that? I mean, what kind of conversations and dialogue can you have with somebody who's black and who says, yeah, we have a new president. Yeah, we're taking control of the House and the Senate, and Georgia's great, but I can't take this anymore.
Well, you know, you can't blame people. And, you know, I sort of, with tongue in cheek, but only partially, say that our health as a black man, that our health requires periodically we leave the United States to get away from this. But we can't really get away from it. At the height of the election season, I talked to friends in Australia and New Zealand, and there was all the talk about, well, you know, maybe I'll just move to New Zealand. And I'm one of those people who have the capacity to do that, both in terms of my resources and in my career. But our friends in New Zealand and Australia said, you know, you're welcome, but we actually need you to fix the United States, because if the United States is not fixed, the whole world suffers. You can't leave, you know, we're not going to Mars. Tribe called Quest already told us that. We're stuck here on Earth. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't be able to pull back, go places. And some people might just give up. It's not a real solution. We can't retreat from this thing. It's like climate change. It affects the entire climate. It affects the entire world. And now some places are going to be worse off than others, but there's no place that's going to be spared. And I traveled. I've lived in Africa, India, done work in Latin America. Race is there. And that's different than it is in the United States. And there are other expressions that are also important, like caste in India, lived in India. You know, so again, we may not want to constantly be on the negative end of that or even to deal with it, but it's not going to go away by itself. And there's no place to go. There's no mecca for us to go and just kick back. And the second thing, of course, is that I remember when David Duke was running, and I talked to my children about this, and they were afraid. They said, should we leave? He's part of the KKK, and he might become governor, and he might even become president. And at one point, I said to my children, I have a daughter and a son, you know, maybe you guys should leave, you know, but I'm going to stay here, because a lot of people can't leave. We have cousins, we have nieces and nephews, we have just the black community who, you know, if you can't pay your house note, you're not going to leave the country. And then I said, plus, it's not his country. You know, it's our country. And I said, but you guys can leave, and I'll support that if you want to do that. And my daughter, who was like 12 at the time, said, I'm not leaving either. It's not his country. And so part of it is we may need to have retreat, but retreat is just a short period of time. Then we need to get back into it. That's the way I approach it.
Hmm. But do you see the conversation changing? Because you also talk about, you know, how we talk about each other and the divisiveness in this country. You said we have to stop talking in binaries and not talk in labels, and you call it breaking language. And, you know, that makes it hard for social solidarity. Can you talk a little bit about that, even in a post-Trump America? How then should we be talking to each other about each other, in your view?
Well, one, I think we have to actually connect on a human level, but also an institutional level. So if you think about it, it's quite interesting. In 1920, 1930, there was pretty strong tensions in the white community. It was a big deal if you were Polish-American versus German-American versus Irish-American versus and so on. And there are people who studied that in terms of they talked about inter-ethnic and inter-religious marriage. That was a big deal. Not as big a deal as interracial, but it was a big deal. That shifted. It shifted so much that some of the people who did work in that area had to almost look for a new thing to study because it was no longer an issue. And now what happened is that the country traded in its organizing around ethnic identity to being organized more acutely around racial identity. So people traded in their Polish-Americanness for whiteness. And they still have a few, you know, Polish communities, but they're not the same. And part of it is people's proximity. And that proximity landed in a place we call the suburbs that didn't exist for the most part before 1940. And part of it is the structure. A lot of people sort of start to write, part of the thing that happens that supports the polarization in the country, as well as the gerrymandering in the country, is the political way that we approach geography. So again, going back to Georgia, Fulton County and Cobb County was the home of Newt Gingrich. It was a solidly red, right-wing place. That just voted for two Democratic senators. It's actually multiracial now. That's not just the demographics change, the values change, the way people think about it change. And it gives an opportunity for people to actually see each other, to experience each other, to have the kids going to school together, to watch them play sports together. So we have to be more deliberate about that. We have to say, okay, we have this really virulent polarization along racial and other lines, but along racial lines, that's stacked upon our party polarization, it's going to tear at the fabric of the country, if not tear the country apart. How do we begin to address that? And part of it is to give people examples. So how do you listen to people who disagree with you? How do you talk to people who disagree with you? You don't do it by just with facts, and you don't do it by yelling at them. You don't do it by calling them names. You engage in what's called compassionate and empathetic practices, both listening and institutions. You don't create these false fights over apparent scarce resources. You don't create zero-sum situations. Mm. One group wins, another group loses. And that's where the country is now. So the assumption is if white people win, especially Trump people, then black people, people of color, lose. If black people win, then the Proud Boys worry that we're going to disappear. There's not going to be a place for us in America. And part of it's the failure of practice, but part of it's the failure of imagination. Most Americans, many Americans, I won't say most, many Americans can't imagine a harmonious, healthy, multiracial, multiethnic society. Instead, what we do is we, question earlier, if you're black, maybe you have to leave the country. If you're white, maybe you may move to the far-fling suburbs in a gated community. But that's still not living together. That's sharing this continent or this subcontinent together, but it's not sharing each other's lives. It's not listening to each other's stories. And we can actually do that over and over again. And we'll learn and we'll make mistakes. But right now, we don't do that.
How do we take this from academic conversations on fora to the street, to the suburb? The dialogue is so divisive right now. How do we really do what you're saying and create this change in the way people communicate with each other, in the way people relate to one another in this time? Are you hopeful this can happen right now?
So it certainly could happen. I don't describe myself as an optimist or pessimist. I describe myself as a possibilist. And by that, I mean what we do matter. Things are possible. It doesn't mean we're going to necessarily get what we want, but if we don't engage, let's say, for every shot you don't take, that's a shot you missed. And you know, let me just come back to academic. A good academician, a good researcher, is a weather person. So you look outside, it's sunny, and you say, you know, nice weather. A weather person says, you know, the barometric pressure is falling, and it's going to be a storm in 12 hours. It's like, well, how do you know? And so the reason I could say at the Democratic Convention that we weren't post-racial is white resentment was already there. You know, it wasn't explicit, but we could measure it. We could measure it increasing. And it's not just people. People are responding to things. So we need leadership as well from all sectors, from the religious sector, from community organizers, to corporate, to government. Instead, what we have is many leaders, certainly since the civil rights movement, using festering white resentment, festering fear, festering anxiety to stoke it up for their own benefit. You know, one of the Koch brothers recently said he made a mistake in terms of supporting the kind of polarization that existed in the country today. Now, it'd be interesting. Will he take his billions and start using it to actually bring people together? Murdoch, when he took over Fox News, the country wasn't so divided. But he actually turned the news. He weaponized information. He weaponized knowledge. So it's not just people. It is people. But it's also people. Some people have more power and influence than others. And they have used this, their power and influence, too often to divide people. We need to have some of those people use their power and influence to bring people together. And then we need to have everyday experiences. And we've seen it happen before. It can happen again. Will we do it? I don't know. But we are seeing more and more people. So if you think about the marches in response to the killing of George Floyd, that was the largest set of demonstrations in American history. And it was populated, led by the Black community, but populated by every community and populated by every part of the country, from police chiefs to corporate heads to church leaders, and not just in the United States, but all over the world. But we have to take that. We have to harness that energy and institutionalize it into our daily practice. So we really believe that Black Lives Matter. We really believe that police should not be able to kill Black people with impunity, regardless to what race you are, regardless to that may never happen in your community. How do you do that? And it's not simply rooting out the bad police. It's changing the structure and culture of policing in the country as a whole.
Where do you see Trumpism from now onward? What's happened? What's going to happen to it?
Well, I think I said earlier, you know, I'm a part of a book on Trumpism and its discontent. And in that book, we talk about the seeds of Trumpism. The United States has always been at war with itself, particularly around race. And so, you know, literally, the Civil War, more people died in that war than all the wars combined in the United States. And the fight was, is the country a country that's open to all the people in a meaningful way? Is the religious question, am I my brother? Not simply, am I my brother's keeper? But am I my brother's and sister's brother and sister? Can I recognize people of a different race, different ethnicity, different ability, different sexual orientation as part of me, as part of the family? And the United States has been ambivalent. We expand the we, then we contract it. When we expand it, some groups feel threatened, then we contract it. And that's what President Obama talks about when he talks about creating a more perfect union. That's what Lincoln's Gettysburg Address is about. Can we actually have a new birth of freedom? Can we correct some of those failures from the very beginning? And we have had some success, and then we've had some setbacks. So yes, I think, and it's called upon us not just to do it at the national level, but to also think globally. The earth, the globe is smaller. Can we live? Can we share with Europe, with Latin America, with Africa, with China? And if we don't, it doesn't bode well for the future of human life on the planet. But I think we can.
You said, I think we can.
Yeah, you know, we certainly can. Will we do it? And then we need to lift up examples. People are doing it all the time. People, you know, there's these small expressions, sometimes bigger expressions. We need to, you know, you're in news, but, you know, you used to say, if it leads, it leads. So people like to hear bad stories. We have to change that. We have to give people examples, because if you can't imagine a better world, then you can't build a better world.